Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Jaron Lanier, who is a computer scientist, a composer, a visual artist, and an author. Jaron, welcome to back to the campus.
Glad to be here.
Tell us a little about your background. Where were you born and raised?
I'm from New Mexico, southern New Mexico. Grew up in a rural area.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
I had bohemian parents, oddballs. My mom was a Holocaust survivor. She died in a car accident in my childhood. My dad was quite the bohemian, had lived with Gurdjieff, if you're familiar with that figure, and other early 20th century crazies. And I grew up in this rural, I would say a backward place, a place that I have mostly not very fond memories of. It amuses me that there's a kind of a nostalgia for the supposed agrarian and enlightenment that we've lost in the city. And I have to say, I lived in it, and it wasn't enlightened at all. It was cruel and tribal and mean. But at any rate, I grew up there, and I was pretty alone, probably the only Jewish kid in quite a large zone. And I happened to latch on to a great local resource, which was a university, New Mexico State University, that existed because of the White Sands Missile Range. So I had access to wonderful math and computer and physics and chemistry departments when I was quite young, and got on this kick of science and technology, which I've enjoyed very much.
And one of the things that stuck out on your website was that you have no academic degrees. And
yeah, somehow that never worked out. I'll tell you what happened. I started school early, and by the time I was the age that most kids are starting school, I had already essentially completed the requirements for a bachelor's and was starting in graduate school. But then I met this exotic character who had a goatee and described himself as a poet, and I'd never met anyone like this. And he inspired me to run off to the East Coast to an elite art school where poets and composers went. And I just ran off there and flunked out almost immediately because I simply didn't fit in. This was a world of these, essentially spoiled kids, of very rich kids. I'd never seen creatures like this. I didn't understand their social code, and I simply could never adapt to it. Now I understand it very well, all too well, but at the time I didn't. So I flunked out, which was a little bit of a shock, and I never recovered from that, but I also never really was motivated to, because I immediately found that I could both earn a living and find ways to do the work I wanted to do without going back into the degree earning process. And while I've never had a tenured position, I think I've collected the widest variety of adjunct positions of anyone. And I seem to be able to get by. I don't recommend to kids to try this route. Mm-hmm. It worked out for me, but I think it's unusual. Mm-hmm. So don't try this at home.
and from your early years, you also got very much interested in music, too. That has always been a parallel to this.
I think of myself as a musician first, probably, but my mom was a concert pianist as a girl, a prodigy. I feel most at home playing unusual music for people. This is a world that rewards my science and technical side more readily than my musical side, perhaps, but I adore making music. I adore communing with musicians, who I think are the most gracious community I've ever found.
Mm-hmm. And so at a point in your early in your career, you come out west to Silicon Valley, right? What drew you out here?
You know what? Initially, my escape from New Mexico was to New York City, where that art school was, and then I got involved in being a musician and composer in Manhattan, which was financially quite challenging. Came back to New Mexico, and you know what happened was funny. I was a kid at this point. I'm 17 or 18 by now, and I fell in love hard for the first time with a girl who was out visiting her mom. Her parents were divorced, and her mom happened to live in this town in New Mexico. Her dad was the head of the physics department at Caltech, so I chased her back to L.A., and I ended up just kind of being hanger-on around Caltech, and which initiated me with my sort of informal lifelong association with physicists, which is another continuing adventure. And I still know the girl. She's married and living in Vienna, and that all worked out well. A while ago, neither of us could even remember the name of the pimply kid who she left me for, which was a very, very big deal when I was 17. And when I realized neither of us could remember him, I was quite upset, let me tell you. But anyway, this was long ago.
Now, in your work, you were a pioneer in what is called virtual reality. Mm-hmm. Talk about how you got into that, because it's very clear that in the body of your work, there is a real interest in technology, development of technology, mm-hmm. but also an effort to relate it to human communication.
Yeah, well, my initial motivation for virtual reality is a little different from what's come to be my primary motivation over the years. But my initial motivation had to do with trying to come up with a vernacular access path to mathematics. So my feeling is that mathematics is a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful language. It's a beautiful set of ideas that most people are excluded from and feel terrified of. And my guess as to why there is that gap, that failure of communication, is that the language of mathematics is almost cruel in its obscurity. And there's a little bit of a deliberate history to that. I mean, academics have often tried to exclude the public from what they do. But in particular with mathematics, because it had to be written down by pencil, a lot of complicated ideas had to be compressed into little symbols you could write on a page. And now with computer graphics and all, maybe we could animate and turn these things into some other expression. So as I was trying to do this on unconventional computer screens, I ran into the problem of running out of the end of the screen, so I wanted to be able to be immersed inside it. Now, the idea of being immersed in a virtual world dates back well before my time to Ivan Sutherland's work in the 60s. And what I did that was an extension of Ivan's work was to take the virtual world and put the human body into it by measuring the hands and the whole body so that you were physically in there, but then more importantly perhaps create a social environment where multiple people were in the virtual world and could look at each other and there would be a version of you, and this is the idea of the avatar, and then you'd have to become a sort of a puppet of yourself. But the interesting thing is that there was a form of expression which still needs to be explored much further where you could turn into an idea. So for instance, your body could become a triangle and you could become almost like a dance expressing trigonometry. And this sort of route into mathematics, I believe, will someday be as common as singing a tune or just speaking. I believe this will be the future of the expression of mathematics, but it'll take quite a while to formulate. So this was my initial interest.
And you coined the term virtual reality. You were the first one to build an avatar. Say build?
The actual first avatar design itself was done by Ann Lasko in the lab. But so I mean, all of these things are actually team efforts, and one shouldn't credit me without mentioning a whole slew of other people, Tom Zimmerman and many others. So it's a bit tricky. But I often end up writing letters to journals saying you can't just credit me, you must credit all these other people. But at any rate, I did make up the term virtual reality, which I don't think is a great term, but it seems to have resonance and it's stuck around. So.
You were very young when this happened, and you were very idealistic and hopeful in terms of in what ways did virtual reality live up or not live up to your expectations?
Well, you know, we're just entering the era in which we'll start to see what happens with it, because from the very beginning, we knew it would take this long for the technology components to catch up. So if you think of virtual reality as an industrial technology, it's easily met all expectations we could have had. You cannot drive in a car that wasn't designed in virtual reality. If you have surgery, your surgical procedure was probably improved in a virtual reality simulation. There are a whole host of ways in which virtual reality is behind the scenes doing good work these days, which we're extremely pleased with. Now, the idea of virtual reality as something that people have direct contact with is another matter. And right now, perhaps the closest thing we have is the video game market, which for the most part I find very disappointing. It's mostly not very creative. It's mostly a slightly interactive version of a movie with very, very, very repetitive and mundane gaming principles and very little opportunity for creativity. But I'm still hopeful. I still have my idealism. And what I'm hoping will happen, and this is my crazy idealism, this might be where I'm a nutcase, I don't know, but if I'm a nutcase, I choose it. I celebrate my nuttiness, and I hope others might join me in it. what I believe is that by having access to good quality virtual reality, where you can be creative, where you can make up the world, we're going to start to see an emergent new form of language, essentially, which I call post-symbolic communication, which means a way to share experience by directly making it up instead of talking about it with symbols. And the reason I like that is because I think there'll be a kind of intimacy to it that'll be charming and that will extend some of the energy of childhood into the adult experience. And I think it'll just be a beautiful extension of culture. So that's what I'm really going for. That's my new interest in virtual reality.
Mm-hmm. And this, we can't cover all that you've done, and we want to talk about mm-hmm. the music, but your the next big project was tele-immersion, and talk a little about that, because again, you're trying to create a world which replicates or comes very near to human experience and human interaction and communication.
Right. Well, this was during the 90s. I had a job as the chief scientist of the engineering lab of Internet 2. And Internet 2 was the collaborative lab of most of the American research universities to study Internet-related things. And what my main project when I had that was this thing called tele-immersion, which is to try to make what you might call a fully realistic avatar or a version of a person of virtual reality that looks like the person so that you simulate physical co-presence. There are two reasons we tried to do that. One was just for the bravura joy of it, to say here we've really pushed virtual reality to an extreme, even if realism isn't what you ultimately want, to prove you can do it gives you other options as well. But the other reason is there's a scientific agenda here, which is understanding human perception. And all along from the very beginning, there have really been two sides to virtual reality. On the one hand, it's a technology that you can make and then do things with. But then on the other hand, it's a scientific instrument that you can use to study how people holistically perceive and understand the world. Prior to virtual reality instruments, you could measure a little thing about vision, a little thing about touch. But with virtual reality, you have this whole simulation, so you can study whether you really understand how the human sensorum works. And so this was an extension of that research, which continues, which I'm very, very devoted to.
And a company spun off of this, which sounded very interesting. iMatics, is that what it's called?
Well, iMatic is no more.
Okay.
One thread of research, which was one of my very favorite ones, was a collaboration with a wonderful neuroscientist at USC named Christoph von der Marsberg. And what we were doing there is looking at mathematical models of how the visual cortex, which is located in the back of your head and is the portion of your brain tissue that immediately receive signals from your eyes, how the visual cortex is able to represent visual objects that you see, and what kind of pattern they turn into once they enter the brain. And we tested a hypothesis of how that works, and we were able to make some wonderful little technological toys out of it, including a magic mirror where a camera would look at your face, and then on a screen you could see your instant facial expressions, smiles and frowns, so forth, transferred to either a fantasy character or to yourself or to another person. And we were able to really abstract the facial expression component of our perception of other people and apply it in different ways, which is one aspect of doing this trick of tele-immersion. And that's one of two major collaborations I've had with neuroscientists. So in trying to study the sensorum, inevitably you go a layer deeper and try to understand a little bit of how the brain connects to this world of the senses.
And does your current work continue this kind of study? The CoCoDEX work?
Well, now the CoCoDEX is the new consortium of researchers I'm working with in the 2000s. And this involves yet another instrumentation strategy, whereas before we've had either helmets or special rooms that create the virtual reality illusion. Now we have a device which is sort of like a quick robot arm that holds various sensors and displays in front of your face as you move around in order to achieve results that we couldn't achieve with any of the other devices. And because we believe, we haven't tested this instrumentation yet, it's still being built, but we believe this instrumentation will get us one round closer to being able to test even more sophisticated hypotheses of how people perceive each other. And this is, from a scientific point of view, this is the agenda of virtual reality, to understand the perception, to understand human perception holistically, and in particular of other people. One of the things I often tell people about this research is that if you go back a century, about almost exactly a century ago, in about 1905, you have E.M. Forster's short story, The Machine Stops, which was the most impressive act of prediction of media technology. It predicts the web and email and all these things. And Forster, along with everyone else in his era, predicted that video conferencing or a simulation of presence at a distance would be commonplace in the era of electricity. And it's the one gadget, aside from the flying car, of course, that's never appeared. We know why flying cars don't appear, but we don't understand yet why the simulation of presence at a distance, visual telecommunications, we still don't understand why this thing hasn't worked. And I'm determined to answer that question and, if possible, solve it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's an irony here, because in this work, you are helping to create devices, machines, whatever, that have very close to human qualities. But as a philosopher, which you are, is another hat that you wear, you've been very critical and even put out what you called a half manifesto against ideas that suggests that the work in technology could create a future paradise in essence which robots are human and humans are subsidiary to robots.
Well, in my view, technology and culture co-create each other, and I think any technologist has responsibility to be culturally literate and to be an active and compassionate cultural player. Now, I have a very strong line of disagreement with many of my colleagues about the cultural context and meaning for a lot of the work we're doing in digital technology. So I don't believe that presents a conflict, because I really have a fundamental trust in people at large that they'll see through the nonsense and that this will work out okay in the long term. So what I do is I make the technology that I think is worthwhile, and then I also try to be a cultural player. So a lot of my colleagues are very technology-centered, and they do have this notion that just making better technology in itself is a reason for life, and that the technology is more important than people, essentially, and that ultimately some sort of perfected computer will be more intelligent than people and will inherit reality, and people will have been just a side effect of the creation of this perfection. I find that to be a dismal and abhorrent philosophy. I absolutely don't support it, and I think there are a multitude of things wrong with it, and so I try to present an alternate one in which we work together towards a future of improved connection between people, of enhanced creativity, of enhanced expressiveness, as opposed to just the power of the machine. And so I try to work towards a human-centered future. But anyway, this is an ongoing debate.
Let's look a little at the assumption of the people on the other side, because they, and I'm going to give a rough synopsis here, and I'm not a technologist, but in other words, that they have, their notions are built on, it seems, Darwinian ideas about a future in which Moore's law applies, and you're essentially arguing, as I understand it, that it's that their assumptions relate to the hardware issue, you know, where clearly in very short periods of time we're exponentially increasing the power of computers, but what they're ignoring is what you call the software problem. Would you explain that? Because I think it's a fascinating insight which would help our audience understand this debate.
Sure. Well, we should first explain Moore's law. So Moore's law is an existential principle of Silicon Valley, and it's that silicon chips keep on getting roughly twice as good and half the price every year and a half, more or less. This is a something that's been going on since the origin of microelectronics, and it is what drives the industry. It means that computers get better and better, and more types of gadgets are enabled over time. Now, contrary to Moore's law, we have software, which is required to make computers do anything. And the interesting thing about software is if you write larger and larger programs to take advantage of these computers, they tend to have more and more bugs and difficulties. And if you believe that the important thing about computers is how much raw power there is, then you see this curve of them getting better and better, and then at some point, maybe a couple decades from now, it kind of zooms into a near infinitely vertical ascent, which is what is called the singularity, when computers become so much better so quickly that humans can no longer comprehend their splendor. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the problems related to software, which is sort of the mirror image, around the same time, you have software descending into an absolutely impassable morass in which no bigger program can ever be written. So, between these two trends is the truth, which is a characteristic of reality, in which you have conflicting trends and chaos, and you have just as in evolution, you don't have the smooth motion of evolution, you have punctuated equilibria. Same thing with this. You have a very complex pattern of progress, and of course, technologists would prefer to only see the good news. Who wouldn't? And so they tend to believe that they're riding this chariot to heaven on this kind of this inevitably improving computer that will become transcendent. I think it's nonsense. I really do. But there are people who believe it. In fact, I would say it's the dominant school of thought in the academic computer science world now, which I think is a shame.
Mm-hmm. And what in your background leads you to be such a humanist in the context of your success as a technologist?
That's an interesting question. It might be that I flunked out of art school when I was 17 so that I never really got back on the academic track. I can imagine, had I not done that, I would have earned my PhD, and I would have been, instead of just being a kid in Marvin Minsky's basement, who's a prominent proponent of these types of ideas based at MIT, and kind of being mentored by him informally, I would have actually had him as an advisor and wouldn't have been able to be such a thorn in his side. Mm-hmm. I adore him, but I just disagree with him. And similarly for other figures, I think maybe it made me more independent. I'm not sure about that. I know from a very young age, when I first was around this body of thought at 16 or 17, I immediately felt that it was wrong. It bothered me immensely on many levels. It seemed as though there was it created an absurdity where we were all trying to build this machine for its own sake, but the only measure of that machine was us. So we ended up doing nothing. We ended up just launching one absurdity on top of another, and I felt it was a completely ungrounded program.
Now this group of technologists who embrace these ideas, you coined the term cybernetic totalists, basically.
Right.
Now, interestingly enough, for somebody who doesn't study this, in reading some of your writing, you were at some point talking about communism, and you said communism did not acknowledge the existence of human experience beyond the scope of its own ideas, and then you go on to suggest that there was a vanity about it. So this is parallel to what you're observing among your adversaries in the battle of ideas, right?
Right. Well, I mean, this is commonplace to all totalisms. All absolutists are vain. And that's essentially what the game is. And I'm important. I'm the master of reality. My ideas are of such importance that they transcend even death. I mean, this is the oldest game in the book. And as long as the people who believe that are not too powerful, it can be charming. However, the nature of the power of technologists is a little different from previous forms of power. If some of these figures, like a Marvin Minsky or a Ray Kurzweil or any of a number of other ones, are unlikely to run for political office. They're unlikely to become a figure like Oprah, who's explicitly a cultural leader. But what they do is they create the tools that all of us live our, organize our lives through, like our computers and our various gadgets. And those actually contain a structure that embed their ideas. And through that indirect route, they actually have enormous influence. And they also have enormous influence in the academy. And I believe they've had an influence in everything from medicine to economics that in some cases has been helpful, but also in some cases has been confusing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you in your philosophical writings, if I can, mm-hmm. I will call them that, you were very sensitive to power, to mm-hmm. issues of justice and equity. And in one piece that I read on infrastructure that you wrote, you talk about that architecture is politics, which is the idea that you just conveyed, mm-hmm. namely that you. Let me bring up this point that you made earlier, that the legacy in software sets us down a road which we can't retreat from. You use the example of files, which at one time was a very good idea, but in as it became embedded in the traditions, has created mm-hmm. something that we have to work around.
Well, traditionally, the way one person influences another person is through talk. You meet in the agora and you debate and you speak or you write books. The way you can influence people in the computer age is different. So, for instance, if the architecture of the internet is designed in such a way that a government agency has windows onto what everybody's saying, but they do not have windows onto each other, that embeds a certain kind of power structure that isn't just an interpretive one as it is with rules handed down or policy directives from a Politburo, but it becomes actually embedded in the way people can connect. It becomes actually more mandatory. And thus far, I think we've been pretty lucky with what's been laid down, but it's crucially important that the things that are laid down are well thought out. And I think in terms of liberties, we're actually doing fairly well, although there are perils. What concerns me more is the sort of new humanistic concern of the definition of the human within the context of the information system. So an example I talk about a lot is in Microsoft Word, which is the almost universal means that people use to write. What could be more important than that? There's an artificial intelligence design component in which the program tries to foresee what you want to do, and it corrects your spelling and mm-hmm. and capitalization and such things. But a great example of perhaps where it fails badly is if it believes that you are starting an indented mm-hmm. list, it'll throw you into this mode that you can never get out of, and you just essentially have to go along with it. So you have this very strange thing where you can either bend over backwards to kind of learn what cues it's looking for so that you can create the illusion that it's smart, that it knows you, or you can capitulate and do what it wants you to. But the point is that you're forced to accept the computer sort of as a creative partner and to delegate to yourself a computer-like role instead of a human role. And that process and the fact that people are willing to accept it, in this case, it's not a big deal. It's a very minor point. But as a precedent of what might come, it's deeply disturbing to me. And so I feel it's very, very important to point out this sort of this notion of computer-human equivalence and to try to oppose it at every turn.
And so the real danger here is that this effort might lead to an effort to make people like computers, which has the consequences that you're talking about.
Well, from the point of view of the people doing it, they don't believe that. They believe they're trying to make computers like people, but the problem is that ultimately there's no way. I mean, it's a matter of perspective. The two activities are absolutely equivalent. You can't distinguish them, and that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Is this why, is this kind of thinking behind your very great concern about access and the inequalities that will be created, and what is access about when you're talking about access to the world of all of this technology?
Well, so here's the dilemma we face. On the one hand, there is truth to the neoconservative economists' claim that the rising tide raises all boats, and it's true that there is a noticeable decrease in absolute poverty and so forth. On the other hand, it's also true that if you have an exponential increase in the wealth of those at the top of the economic spectrum, and that that exponent is steeper than those at the bottom, the gap between them widens. And so if you look at this widening thing, even if the bottom is raising somewhat, the gap is widening at an even larger rate. And so you start to have a separation of humanity. And here we go back to another one of the early pieces of speculative fiction from over a century ago, H.G. Wells's Time Machine, in which he foresaw the human species breaking in two over this very issue. And I think his concern was absolutely valid. I mean, I think with this widening gap taking place at the same time that we have an enormous expansion of medical technology and so forth, I'm profoundly concerned essentially that the species could break into two, with one part having designer genes and living longer and this and that. And that this question of information access is not life or death right now, but it's the precedent question that'll set the terms of what medicine and health are like, say, 20 or 30 years from now.
You say in one of your writings, your goal is to find the mysteriousness in each other, and we can do that if we treat the computer as conduits between imaginations rather than as things that are real in their own right, and then new art will be born.
Yeah. I believe that.
Yeah.
I'm a complete idealist.
And we're going to talk about your music in a moment, but one other point that emerged in your philosophical writings is this notion of a circle of empathy. In fact, I was just on the Huffington blog, and that was a point that you made, you touched on, I think, in your most recent blog. The more we imagine ourselves becoming machines, the more we risk losing our humanity. Mm-hmm. And you talk about defining a circle of empathy, which helps us in a way. It seems to be a guide for understanding our humanness. And the people you're arguing with, the technologists, in a way, want to put the computer inside that circle of it. Talk a little about that.
By the way, so far as I know, I've been using the term and the idea of the circle of empathy for a longer period of time, but it's also used in exactly the same way by the animal rights activist philosopher from Princeton, Peter Singer. I don't know which of us has priority on it, but at any rate, he uses it in the same way. And the question is, if you draw a circle around yourself and you say, are things within the circle you empathize with, things outside you don't? What's in the circle? Is a fetus in the circle so that you would prohibit abortion? Is an animal in the circle? Is a computer in the circle? And this is a great deal of moral struggle really comes down to what belongs in the circle. And there's a pragmatic sensibility to this because you can't extend the circle to infinity or you become incompetent. This is the tragedy of life. This is the tragedy that every idealistic kid has to face. The problem with putting a computer in the circle is that in empathizing with it, you make yourself like it. And rather than looking into the computer, which no matter how big the computer is, it's not as big as the wilds of reality. I mean, reality is this mysterious sea that you make contact with tentatively as either an artist or a scientist. You're touching this mystery. If you're looking into the computer, you're looking into a reduced mystery that's a maze of ideas that have been represented. But reality itself is not represented. It's larger. And so you confine yourself to this smaller thing. And the way out of that is, instead of believing in this little smaller world as having something of value, you treat it as a conduit where it's a filter between people that allows people to see and explore each other in new ways, and then you rediscover the fundamental mysteriousness of reality within that other person on the other side. And so that is the way out. That's the way to have meaning and the benefits of digital technology at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Does this help us understand your love and continuing interest and work in music?
I've been asked this so many. I don't know why I love music. I can tell you a few things. One of the things about music is that it's among the closer experiences we have access to now to what this post-symbolic communication idea might be like, because in improvising music with other people, you're spontaneously creating only form, not content, and post-symbolic communication would have some species of content as yet to be discovered as well. But another thing about instruments that I really love are that they they seem throughout history in various places and times to have really been more advanced than weapons. And so the usual trope is that it's the weapons makers who are at the leading edge of technology, but it appears empirically that actually it's the instrument makers. And I just find this very charming that just making weird sounds for each other has been the driving force of so much technology, that the casting that eventually turned into cannons was initially created by the Chinese for bells. So, and there are many, many other examples like that. The musical bow preceded the hunting bow. Many, many, many other examples. And indeed, I have this guy here.
Yeah, which you're going to show. Before we do that, you'll show it to us. But you collect instruments, and then show us. Tell us about your collection, and then show us.
Well,
that
I don't like to think of myself as collecting instruments, okay, because the aesthetic of the collector is just to hold. I learn to play instruments, and I have a lot of them. I have over 1,300 at my house, and I've traveled all over the place tracking down obscure instruments. I think I have the largest collection in active playing condition now. But they're not like a collector's collection. I was just visiting a large collection in Europe, and it was very sad to me to see all these instruments behind glass, unplayed. And it's good. They'll be preserved longer than mine will be, but mine are all played, and it's a very different thing.
And I read that you at one time you lived in New York, and you lived near the site of the 9/11 attack, I guess, but all your instruments survived. You didn't lose?
I lost quite a few.
Oh, you did lose.
Our building was damaged, yeah. About 40 were completely destroyed, and maybe about 100 or 200 required repair, but some of them are still not repaired.
So show us this instrument now, and I'm going to ask you to play it in a minute, but give us a sense of your relation to this particular one.
Okay.
Give us an idea of what you're doing.
Take some delight in playing instruments. This instrument is one that survived the attack, and since the people who perpetrated the attack outlaw music, screw them.
Where is this? What is the origin?
This particular instrument is from Laos, this particular one, and it's called a can, usually. And this design dates back approximately 4,000 years, not really known. There are variants of it that date back later. It's associated with China and Chinese satellite cultures. I think this is the earliest example of a human artifact that has a binary characteristic where you have multiple similar parts that all have an off-on quality to them. Now, aside from that, I think of it as being the precedent to the modern computer based on a historical string of events. And I'm pushing a little bit here, but it's no crazier than most historical theories. So these things were traded across the Silk Route. Romans copied them, turned them into a big noisemaker in the Colosseum. That evolved into the medieval pipe organ, which included player mechanisms and could play itself in many cases. That turned into the Renaissance player pianos, which could improvise in some cases. That was copied into the Jacquard loom, which is the direct antecedent of digital computers. So there's a case as good as any that this is the most ancient antecedent that you can really trace to the development of the computer.
And how do you learn to play an instrument like this? In other words, does it just come naturally to you, do you do historical research, or when you make the purchase, find out?
In this case, I traveled to the place where these are played, and I spent time with the people. What I'm going to play is not in the traditional style. It's my own funny Western romantic style. So what I do is I start by learning the style to the degree I can, and it depends on the culture. In some cases, there are things you can learn. In other cases, it would take decades, and it's not really plausible to just dip in and really learn to play well. In this case, I think with a year or two of work, anyone could learn to play the folk style that's common on this. And I've developed, as I say, this other style that's a little bit more in a Western tradition.
So would you like to demonstrate it?
Yeah, please.
Play.
So, yeah, very quick.
Now, is the fact that the ear hears that is so beautiful, and I'm not a connoisseur of music particularly, is that making the point that you're trying to make about music as a way to communicate between people and across peoples? And
sure. I mean, music is this wonderful mystery because it's a human universal that really is unexplained. I mean, the best definitions of music are the vaguest ones. Evolutionary psychologists will say it's some sort of spin-off process from sexuality, which certainly seems reasonable to me. You can talk about it as an elaborate form of play for children that teaches certain skills. That seems reasonable. Mm-hmm. It's this fundamental and universal aspect of people that just seems to be beautiful and playful, and I love that it eludes precise description.
Mm-hmm. And for you, this is a distraction from the other work that you do. I mean, is it something that in any way balances the work you're doing with technology? Or
I'm always asked this. I've had a professional music career. The last few years, I haven't pursued it so much living in Berkeley, California, as opposed to Manhattan. It's a little harder, but for periods of my life, I've been a musician first and a scientist second. The best explanation I can have of the relationship of the two lives for me is that of cross-procrastination, which is I play a little game with myself where I'm always procrastinating something, but if mm-hmm. I use the two things to procrastinate against each other, I can always feel like I'm screwing around but still making progress anyway. So that's the best answer I have.
Mm-hmm. You say somewhere, music must seduce technology. How do we do that? How does music seduce technology? In other words, does the technology offer a way to expand music and what we can create in the world of music?
Well, this is something that I have. This is another point of conflict, let's say, with my colleagues, where I feel that a lot of the technological advances of the digital age haven't necessarily worked all that well musically. And a lot of digital music hasn't been successful. And in fact, what I often claim is that the most successful genre that uses digital technology is the angriest and most sort of frustrated and explosive genre, which is hip-hop. And in hip-hop, you have, I think, a use of digital components, but it's almost as if the frustrations of the digital technology are being used as a metaphor for frustrations of angry performers. And so that genre actually works. But in other cases, I think the effects of digital technology have, for the most part, not been as helpful as the earlier generations of technology were for music. And I think the reason for that is just that computers are made of ideas, not materials. I mean, it's not a question of electrons versus metal or wood. It's a question of ideas versus, just working with undifferentiated reality. So ideas aren't as big as the world. So this is made a little bit of ideas, but it's mostly made of materials which are beyond ideas. I have to tell you one story about this. When I was a kid, I had one of these things. I've been playing this for a long time. And I took one apart with a great physicist, Richard Feynman, a long time ago, just to try to test the hypothesis about precisely how it works, because there's a widespread belief of what the physical principle is that allows this to work. And it turns out not to be true. So I'm sure somebody, I haven't wanted to, because I almost like leaving it unknown, but nobody's ever figured this out. I'm sure it could be figured out if anybody really wanted to work at it. But the point is, you can build these things without fully understanding them. This is something that is prior to ideas. And reality in general, the physical world, is bigger than ideas. Ideas are never able to fully contain it. And so, but the computer is made of ideas. So the computer is smaller. So when you make music within just this world of ideas, you're in this little maze of our own creation. And it has a kind of a narcissistic infinite loop quality to it.
Mm-hmm. You say somewhere that people are always moving ahead of the ideas that we've put down to explain them. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think the most successful ideas that people have are the ones that acknowledge their own limitation. So, for instance, I think America on the whole has been a fairly successful experiment in human society, not a perfect one by any means, but compared to the historical record, you know, it's done pretty well, and it's been able to improve itself in some of its areas of greatest failing, like slavery. And if you look at our foundational documents, we have this open-endedness, the pursuit of happiness, but it's not defined. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's a sense that, you know, we can say there's this thing out here, but we can't capture it. There's something beyond us. There's something we can't talk about. We can refer to this other area. And that attitude, I think, is a much healthier way than the sort of the Marxist idea of trying to, or the Hegelian idea of trying to come up with a full system that explains all aspects of life and contains everything, which can never be big enough. And of course, it's dismal to live within ideas. Ideas are never big enough to hold life.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about another thing that you wrote. I think this was in a piece you did for a music festival in New York. I'm not sure, but you said the computer will give birth to a delightful new vernacular art form that combines cinema, jazz, and programming. What, explain that for us.
I remember what that phrase is from. It's actually the 50th anniversary of the computer, and the main academic association that studies for computer scientists, the Association of Computing Machinery, asked me to write a little essay to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the computers. That was from that. So, yeah, the notion is that in the 20th century there are a number of new art forms or craft forms, cinema, jazz, and I counted programming, although I think it's the lesser of the three. And the notion is that this post-symbolic communication I was talking about, in which people are within a virtual world and sort of doing waking state collective intentional dreaming, if you like, as a form of communication. So you directly create something instead of talking about it as a way of sharing it. That sort of thing might eventually, if it comes about, will be seen as a descendant of these forms, where jazz is the most sophisticated improvisational structural form as yet, with the possible exception of improvised conversation, I suppose. And cinema, of course, is the most sophisticated construction of simulated experience as yet, although it might be surpassed by video games very soon. And programming, of course, is the first craft of simulation, which is extremely undeveloped and I think in a very poor state right now, but nonetheless has potential.
In terms of looking at the future, I sense that you're a very hopeful guy, mm-hmm. and that you actually believe that in some way all of these ideas that you have about everything from tele-immersion and virtual reality to a concern about humanity and technology servicing humanity, that there are real possibilities that all of this will come together in a future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an idealist. I'm an optimist. I think that's a nature of being. It doesn't apply necessarily to every idea or every period of time. Right now, I'm pessimistic about what the next chapters of the American experience and the world experience will be like. I think there are quite a number of dismal and foreboding trends that are converging. So I'm worried right now about the immediate future. But in the long term, I retain my optimism, absolutely.
I know you're not a hierarchical type of person. You're not somebody who finds necessarily a pattern in one's life. But I'm curious, how would you advise students about preparing for the future based on reflections on your own life? Is there something that stands out that is consistent with your you know, commitment to diversity and anarchy and all of the things that you
see? I'm not committed to anarchy, by the way.
Yeah, okay.
I wouldn't identify anarchy as a word that
Okay, sorry. I'm just trying to make you come up, or not make you, but ask you if you can come up with some sense of the design.
This actually is relevant to your question. I mean, the reason I would reject the term anarchy is that anarchy suggests that there are changes that, while they might be creative, are disjunctive enough that we lose the benefits of cumulative memory and cumulative culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that the balance has to be creative, to explore, to be as fearless as one can be, but without losing memory. And you need to have some continuity to have that memory. And so, I would be a smoothitarian, or I'm a creative incrementalist, is what I would say. That shock for its own sake is a cheap trick and a poor bet. And so, the anarchist tendency, I think, is an infantile one. Mm-hmm. Now. As far as advice I give to people, I'm asked this all the time, and I work with undergraduates a lot. And right now we're 2005, and I have to say things are rough. I think it's one thing is it's important to take an international perspective right now. It's not clear what the world will look like in 10, 20, 30 years. It might be a good idea to learn some foreign languages and to have a broader base than just the United States. It might be a good idea to try to have not just a cross-disciplinary narrow specialty, but a multidisciplinary expertise, because we really don't know how a number of these things are going to work out. For students of computer science, they have to recognize that the computer science curriculum we have right now is still largely structured by ideas of 20 or 30 years ago, for the simple reason that our entire faculty is still on its cycle of a first generation, so we don't have a diversity of people coming into it from different times. So we have these eminent tenured people who are still running the departments who are from the first generation or the second generation. And so we have an overly conservative program in most places, so you have to learn to fight against that and be very mm-hmm. skeptical. I think it's very important not to get too involved in the trends. Like right now, there would be a tremendous trend to go into certain very narrow fields in biologically related computing. And obviously, by the time one has a career, a lot of those issues will have been resolved. And it's important to have a little bit more breadth. So those are some of the bits of advice I give people.
Mm-hmm. One final question. What have you drawn the most satisfaction out of in terms of your own work? In other words, is it the music or is it the technology? And if it comes out of the either, anything in particular stands out?
You know, this is hard for me because I don't find experience to be quantifiable, so I don't know how to make these comparisons. Mm-hmm. I adore playing music for people. I find digital technology to be a real pain in the butt, so I can't say it's a great pleasure to work on it. But then on the other hand, cumulatively, I enjoy it a great deal, but I can't really isolate any particular experience that is the most joyful one. It's sort of like a technology for me is like this horde of unpleasant moments that can accumulate somehow into a pleasant overall experience. I don't know how that transformation happens. And once in a while, when I can do theoretical work, some of my collaborations with physicists are like this. I have tremendous pleasure in being able to really confront fundamental ideas, and that I like very much.
Jeroen, on that note, and hope for the future, I think there was some of that there, and while looking back at all that you've achieved, I want to thank you very much
for having me.
Being here, and we hope to have you on the campus again, which I'm sure we will at some point.
No doubt.
Okay, thank you, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.